is about him. And do you know what Glenn Bateman did then? That nice man who paints the horrible pictures? He went over and kicked that dead man in the face. Harold made a muffled sort of grunt as if he was the one who had been kicked. Then Glenn drew his foot back again. No, Harold yells, but Glenn kicked the dead man again just the same. Then he turned around and he was wiping his mouth with the back of his hand, but at least his eyes had lost that awful dead fish look. Come on, he says. Let's get out of here. Stu was right. It's a dead place. So we went out, and Stu was sitting with his back to the iron gate in the high wall that ran around the place, and I wanted to... Oh, go ahead, Franny, if you can't tell your diary, who can you tell? I wanted to run to him and kiss him and tell him I was ashamed for all of us not believing him, and ashamed of how all of us had gone on about what a hard time we'd had when the plague was on, and him hardly saying anything when all the time that man had almost killed him. Oh, dear, I'm falling in love with him. I think I've got the world's most crushable crush. If only it wasn't for Harold, I'd take my damn chances. Anyway, there's always an anyway, even though by now my fingers are so numb they're just about falling off. That was when Stu told us for the first time that he wanted to go to Nebraska, that he wanted to check out his dream. He had a stubborn, sort of embarrassed look on his face, as if he knew he was going to have to take some more patronizing shit from Harold. But Harold was too unnerved from our tour of the Stovington facility to offer more than token resistance. And even that stopped when Glenn said, in a very reticent way, that he had also dreamed of the old woman the night before. Of course, it might only be because Stu told us about his dream, he said, kind of red in the face, but it was remarkably similar. Harold said that, of course, that was it, but Stu said, wait a minute, Harold, I've got an idea. His idea was that we all take a sheet of paper and write down everything we could remember of our dreams over the last week, then compare notes. This was just scientific enough so that Harold couldn't grumble too much. Well, the only dream I've had is the one I've already written down, and I won't repeat it. I'll just say I wrote it down, leaving in the part about my father, but leaving out the part about the baby and the coat hanger he always has. The results when we compared our papers were rather amazing. Harold, Stu, and I had all dreamed about the Dark Man, as I call him. Both Stu and I visualized him as a man in a monk's robe with no visible features. His face is always in a shadow. Harold's paper said that he was always standing in a dark doorway, beckoning to him like a pimp. Sometimes he could just see his feet and the shine of his eyes. Like weasel's eyes, is how he put it. Stu and Glenn's dreams of the old woman are very similar. The points of similarity are almost too many to go into, which is my literary way of saying my fingers are going numb. Anyway, they both agree that she is in Polk County, Nebraska, although they couldn't get together on the actual name of the town. Stu says Hollingford home. Glenn says Hemingway home. Close either way. They both seemed to feel they could find it. Note well, diary, my guess is Hemingford home. Glenn said, this is really remarkable. We all seem to be sharing an authentic psychic experience. Harold poo-pooed, of course, but he looked like he'd been given lots of food for thought. He would only agree to go on the basis of, we have to go somewhere. We leave in the morning. I'm scared, excited, and mostly happy to be leaving Stovington, which is a death place, and I'll take that old woman over the Dark Man any time. Things to remember. Hang loose meant don't get upset. Rad and gnarly were ways of saying a thing was good. No sweat meant you weren't worried. To boogie down was to have a good time, and lots of people wore T-shirts which said, shit happens, which it certainly did, and still does. I got grease was a pretty current expression, I first heard it just this year, that meant everything was going well. Digs, an old British expression, was just replacing pad or crash pad as an expression for the place you were living in before the superflu hit. It was very cool to say, I dig your digs. Stupid, huh? But that was life. It was just after 12 noon. Parian had fallen into an exhausted sleep beside Mark, who they had moved carefully into the shade 2 hours earlier. He was in and out of consciousness, and it was easier on all of them when he was out. He had held against the pain for the remainder of the night, but after daybreak he had finally given in to it, and when he was conscious, his screams curdled their blood. They stood looking at each other, helpless. No one had wanted any lunch. "It's his appendix," Glenn said. "I don't think there's any doubt about it." "Maybe we ought to try, well, operating on him," Harold said. He was looking at Glenn. "I don't suppose we'd kill him," Glenn said flatly. "You know that, Harold. If we could open him up without having him bleed to death, which we couldn't, we wouldn't know his appendix from his pancreas. The stuff in there isn't labeled, you know." "We'll kill him if we don't," Harold said. "Do you want to try?" Glenn asked waspishly. "Sometimes I wonder about you, Harold." "I don't see that you're being much help in our current situation either," Harold said, flushing. "No, stop, come on," Stu said. "What good are either of you doing? Unless one of you plans to saw him open with a jackknife, it's out of the question anyway." "Stu?" Franny almost gasped. "Well?" he asked and shrugged. "The nearest hospital would be back in Maumee. We could never get him there. I don't even think we could get him back to the turnpike." "You're right, of course," Glenn muttered and ran a hand over his sandpapery cheek. "Harold, I apologize. I'm very upset. I knew this sort of thing could happen. Pardon me, would happen. But I guess I only knew it in an academic way. This is a lot different than sitting in the old study, blue-skying things." Harold muttered an ungrateful acknowledgement and walked off with his hands stuffed deep into his pockets. He looked like a sulky, overgrown 10-year-old. "Why can't we move him?" Fran asked desperately, looking from Stu to Glenn. "Because of how much his appendix must have swelled by now," Glenn said. "If it bursts, it's going to dump enough poison into his system to kill 10 men. Stu nodded. "Peritonitis." Franny's head whirled. "Appendicitis? That was nothing these days, nothing. Why, sometimes, if you were in the hospital for gallstones or something, they would just lift out your appendix on general principles while they still had you open." She remembered that one of her grammar school friends, a boy named Charlie Biggers, whom everyone had called Biggie, had had his appendix out during the summer between 5th and 6th grades. He was only in the hospital for 2 or 3 days. Having your appendix out was just nothing, medically speaking. Just like having a baby was nothing, medically speaking. "But if you leave him alone," she asked, "won't it burst anyway?" Stu and Glenn looked at each other uncomfortably and said nothing. "Then you're just as bad as Harold says," she burst out wildly. "You've got to do something, even if it is with a jackknife. You've got to." "Why us?" Glenn asked angrily. "Why not you? We don't even have a medical book, for Christ's sweet sake." "But you... it can't happen this way. Having your appendix out is supposed to be nothing." "Well, maybe not in the old days, but it's sure something now," Glenn said. But by then she had blundered off, crying. She came back around 3 o'clock, ashamed of herself and ready to apologize, but neither Glenn nor Stu was in camp. Harold was sitting dejectedly on the trunk of a fallen tree. Parian was sitting cross-legged by Mark, sponging his face with a cloth. She looked pale but composed. "Franny," Harold said, looking up and brightening visibly. "Hi, Harold." She went on to Perry. "How is he?" "Sleeping," Parian said, but he wasn't sleeping. Even Fran could see that. He was unconscious. "Where have the others gone, Perry? Do you know?" It was Harold who answered her. He had come up behind her, and Fran could feel him wanting to touch her hair or put a hand on her shoulder. She didn't want him to. Harold had begun to make her acutely uncomfortable most all of the time. "They've gone to Kunkel to look for a doctor's office." "They thought they could get some books," Perry said, "and some instruments." She swallowed, and her throat made an audible click. She went on cooling Mark's face, occasionally dipping her cloth into one of the canteens and wringing it out. "We're really sorry," Harold said uncomfortably. "I guess that doesn't sound like jack shit, but we really are." Perry looked up and offered Harold a strained, sweet smile. "I know that," she said. Thank you. This is no one's fault. Unless there's a God, of course. If there's a God, then it's his fault. And when I see him, I intend to kick him in the balls. She had a horsey sort of face and a thick peasant's body. Fran, who saw everyone's best features long before she saw the less fortunate ones, Harold, for instance, had a lovely pair of hands for a boy, noticed that Perry's hair, a soft auburn shade, was almost gorgeous, and that her dark indigo eyes were fine and intelligent. She had taught anthropology at NYU, she had told them, and she had also been active in a number of political causes, including women's rights and equal treatment under the law for AIDS victims. She had never been married. Mark, she told Franny once, had been better to her than she had ever expected a man to be. The others she had known had either ignored her or lumped her in with other girls as a pig or a skag. She admitted Mark might have been in the group, which had always just ignored her if conditions had been normal, but they hadn't been. They had met each other in Albany, where Perrion had been summering with her parents on the last day of June, and after some talk they had decided to get out of the city before all the germs incubating in all the decomposing bodies could do to them what the superflu hadn't been able to do. So they had left, and the next night they had become lovers, more out of desperate loneliness than any real attraction. This was girl talk, and Franny hadn't even written it down in her diary. He was good to her, Perry had told Fran in the soft and slightly amazed way of all plain women who have discovered a nice man in a hard world. She began to love him, a little more each day she had begun to love him. And now this. It's funny, she said. Everybody here but Stu and Harold are college graduates, and you certainly would have been if things had gone on in their normal course, Harold. Yes, I guess that's true, Harold said. Perry turned back to Mark and began to sponge his forehead again, gently, with love. Franny was reminded of a color plate in their family Bible, a picture that showed three women making the body of Jesus ready for burial. They were anointing him with oils and spices. Franny was studying English, Glenn was a teacher of sociology, Mark was getting his doctorate in American history. Harold, you'd be in English too, wanting to be a writer. We could sit around and have some wonderful bull sessions. We did, as a matter of fact, didn't we? Yes, Harold agreed. His voice, normally penetrating, was almost too low to hear. A liberal arts education teaches you how to think. I read that somewhere. The hard facts you learn are secondary to that. The big thing you take away from school with you is how to induct and deduct in a constructive way. That's good, Harold said. I like that. Now his hand did drop on Fran's shoulder. She didn't shrug it away, but she was unhappily conscious of its presence. But it isn't good, Perry said fiercely. And in his surprise, Harold took his hand off Fran's shoulder. She felt lighter immediately. No, he asked rather timidly. He's dying, Perry said, not loudly, but in an angry, helpless way. He's dying because we've all been spending our time learning how to bullshit each other in dorms and the living rooms of cheap apartments in college towns. Oh, I could tell you about the Midi Indians of New Guinea, and Harold could explain the literary technique of the later English poets, but what good does any of that do, my Mark? If we had somebody from med school, Fran began tentatively. Yes, if we did, but we don't. We don't even have a car mechanic with us, or someone who went to ag college and might have at least watched once when a vet was working on a cow or a horse. She looked at them, her indigo eyes growing even darker. Much as I like you all, I think at this point I'd trade the whole bunch of you for Mr. Goodwrench. You're all so afraid to touch him, even though you know what's going to happen if you don't. And I'm the same way. I'm not excluding myself. At least the two... Fran stopped. She had been about to say, at least the two men went, then decided that might be unfortunate phrasing with Harold still here. At least Stu and Glenn went. That's something, isn't it? Perry sighed. Yes, that's something. But it was Stu's decision to go, wasn't it? The only one of us who finally decided it would be better to try anything than to just stand around wringing our hands. She looked at Franny. Did he tell you what he did for a living before? He worked in a factory, Fran said promptly. She did not notice that Harold's brow clouded at how quickly she was able to come up with this information. He put circuits in electronic calculators. I guess you could say he was a computer technician. Ha! Harold said and smiled sourly. He's the only one of us who understands taking things apart, Perry said. What he and Mr. Bateman do will kill Mark, I'm almost sure it will. But it's better that he be killed while somebody is trying to make him well than it would be for him to die while we just stand around watching, as if he were a dog that had been run over in the street. Neither Harold nor Fran could find a reply to that. They only stood behind her and watched Mark's pale, still face. After a while, Harold put his sweaty hand on Fran's shoulder again. It made her feel like screaming. Stu and Glenn got back at 4:15. They had taken one of the cycles. Tied behind it was a doctor's black bag of instruments and several large black books. "We'll try," was all Stu said. Perry looked up. Her face was white and strained, her voice calm. "Would you, please? We both want you to," she said. "Stu?" Perrion said. It was 4:10. Stu was kneeling on a rubber sheet that had been spread under the tree. Sweat was pouring from his face in rivers. His eyes looked bright and haunted and frantic. Franny was holding a book open in front of him, switching back and forth between two colored plates whenever Stu raised his eyes and nodded at her. Beside him, horribly white, Glenn Bateman held a spool of fine white thread. Between them was an open case of stainless steel instruments. The case was now splashed with blood. "It's here," Stu cried. His voice was suddenly high and hard and exultant. His eyes had narrowed to two points. "Here's the little bastard. Here, right here." "Stu," Perrion said. "Fran, show me that other plate again. Quick, quick." "Can you take it out?" Glenn asked. "Jesus, he's Texas. Do you really think you can?" Harold was gone. He had left the party early, holding one hand cupped over his mouth. He had been standing in a small grove of trees to the east, his back to them, for the last 15 minutes. Now he turned back, his large round face hopeful. "I don't know," Stu said, "but I might, I just might." He stared at the color plate Fran was showing him. He was wearing blood up to his elbows, like scarlet evening gloves. "Stu," Perrion said. "It's self-containing above and below," Stu whispered. His eyes glittered fantastically. "The appendix. It's its own little unit. Wipe my forehead, Franny. Jesus, I'm sweating like a fucking pig. Thanks. God, I don't want to cut his doings any worse than I have to. That's his ever fucking intestines, but Christ, I gotta. "Stu," Perrion said. "Give me the scissors, Glenn. No, not those, the small pair. Stu!" He looked at her at last. "You don't need to." Her voice was calm, soft. "He's dead." Stu looked at her, his narrowed eyes slowly widening. She nodded. "Almost 2 minutes ago. But thank you. Thank you for trying." Stu looked at her for a long time. "You're sure?" he whispered at last. She nodded again. Tears were spilling silently down her face. Stu turned away from them, dropped the small scalpel he had been holding, and put his hands over his eyes in a gesture of utter despair. Glenn had already gotten up and walked off, not looking back, his shoulders hunched, as if from a blow. Franny put her arms around Stu and hugged him. "That's that," he said. He said it over and over again, speaking in a slow and toneless way that frightened her. "That's that. All over. That's that. That's that." "You did the best you could," she said, and hugged him even tighter, as if he might fly away. "That's that," he said again, with dull finality. Franny hugged him. Despite all her thoughts of the last 3.5 weeks, despite her crushable crush, she had not made a single overt move. She had been almost painfully careful not to show the way she felt. The situation with Harold was just too much on a hair trigger, and she was not showing the true way she felt about Stu even now, not really. It was not a lover's hug she was bestowing on him. It was simply one survivor clinging to another. Stu seemed to understand this. His hands came up to her shoulders and pressed them firmly, leaving bloody handprints on her khaki shirt, marking her in a way which seemed to make them partners in some unhappy crime. Somewhere a jay cawed harshly, and closer at hand, Parian began to weep. Harold Lauder, who did not know the difference between the hugs survivors and lovers may bestow on each other, gazed at Franny and Stu with dawning suspicion and fear. After a long moment, he crashed furiously off into the brush and didn't come back until long after supper. She woke up early the next morning. Someone was shaking her. "I'll open my eyes and it'll be Glenn or Harold," she thought sleepily. "We're going to go through it again, and we'll keep going through it until we get it right. Those who do not learn from history." But it was Stu, and it was already daylight of a sort, creeping dawn, muffled in early mist like fresh gold wrapped in thin cotton. The others were sleeping humps. "What is it?" she asked, sitting up. "Is something wrong?" "I was dreaming again," he said. "Not the old woman, the other one. The dark man. I was scared, so I—"
"Stop it," she said, frightened by the look on his face. "Say what you mean, please."
"It's Parian. The Varinol. She got the Varinol out of Glenn's pack." She hissed in breath.
"Oh, boy," Stu said brokenly. "She's dead, Franny. Oh, Lord, ain't this some mess."
She tried to speak and found she could not.
"I guess I've got to wake the other two up," Stu said in an absent sort of way.
He rubbed at his cheek, which was sandpapery with beard. Fran could still remember how it had felt against her own cheek yesterday when she had hugged him. He turned back to her, bewildered.
"When does it end?"
She said softly,
"I don't think it ever will."
Their eyes locked in the early dawn. From Fran Goldsmith's diary, July 12, 1990. "We're camped just west of Gilderland, New York, tonight. Have finally made it onto the big highway, Route 8090. The excitement of meeting Mark and Parian, don't you think that's a pretty name? I do. Yesterday afternoon has more or less abated. They have agreed to throw in with us. In fact, they made the suggestion before any of us could. Not that I'm sure Harold would have offered. You know how he is. And he was a little put off, I think Glenn was too, by all the hardware they were carrying, including semi-automatic rifles, too. But mostly Harold just had to have his little song and dance. He has to register his presence, you know. I guess I have filled up pages and pages with The Psychology of Harold, and if you don't know him by now, you never will. Underneath his swagger and all those pompous pronouncements, there is a very insecure little boy. He can't really believe that things have changed. Part of him, quite a large part, I think, has to go on believing that all his high school tormentors are going to rise out of their graves one fine day and start shooting spitballs at him again, or maybe calling him whack-off Lauder, as Amy said they used to do. Sometimes I think it would have been better for him, and maybe me too, if we hadn't hooked up back in Agunquit. I'm part of his old life. I was best friends with his sister once upon a time, and so on and so on. What sums up my weird relationship with Harold is this. Strange as it may seem, knowing what I know now, I would probably pick Harold to be friends with instead of Amy, who was mostly dizzy about boys with nice cars and clothes from sweeties, and who was, God forgive me for saying cruddy things about the dead, but it's true, a real Agunquit snob, the way only a year-round townie can be one. Harold is, in his own weird way, sort of cool, when he's not concentrating all his mental energies on being an asshole, that is. But, you see, Harold could never believe that anyone could think he was cool. Part of him has such a huge investment in being square. He is determined to carry all of his problems right along with him into this not-so-brave new world. He might as well have them packed right inside his knapsack, along with those chocolate payday candy bars he likes to eat.
Oh, Harold, jeez, I just don't know. Things to remember. The Gillette parrot. Please don't squeeze the Charmin. The walking Kool-Aid pitcher that used to say, oh, yeah. OB tampons. Created by a woman gynecologist. Converse All-Stars. Night of the Living Dead. Brr, that last one hits too close to home. I quit. July 14th, 1990. We had a very long and very sober talk about these dreams today at lunch, stopping much longer than we should have, probably. We're just north of Batavia, New York, by the way. Yesterday, Harold very diffidently, for him, suggested we start stocking up on Veranol and hitting ourselves with very light doses to see if we couldn't disrupt the dream cycle, as he put it. I went along with the idea so no one would start to wonder if something might be wrong with me, but I planned to palm my dose because I don't know what it might do to the Lone Ranger. I hope he's lone. I'm not sure I could face twins. With the Veranol proposal adopted, Mark had a comment. You know, he says, things like this really don't bear too much thinking about. The next thing you know, we'll all be thinking we're Moses or Joseph, getting telephone calls from God. That dark man isn't calling from heaven, Stu says. If it's a toll call, I think it's coming from someplace a lot lower down. Which is Stu's way of saying old Scratch is after us, Franny pipes up. And that's as good an explanation as any other, Glenn says. We all looked at him. Well, he went on, a little on the defensive, I think, if you look at it from a theological point of view, it does rather seem as if we're the knot in a tug-of-war rope between heaven and hell, doesn't it? If there are any Jesuit survivors of the superflu, they must be going absolutely bananas. That made Mark laugh his head off. I didn't really get it, but kept my mouth shut. Well, I think the whole thing is ridiculous, Harold put in. You'll be getting around to Edgar Cayce and the transmigration of souls before we know it. He pronounced Casey, Case, and when I corrected him, you say it like the initials for Kansas City, he gave me a really horrid Harold frown. He isn't the type of guy who swamps you with gratitude when you point out his little flaws, diary. Whenever something overtly paranormal occurs, Glenn said, the only explanation that really fits well and holds its interior logic is the theological one. That's why psychics and religion have always gone hand in hand, right up to your modern-day faith healers. Harold was grumbling, but Glenn went on anyway. My own gut feeling is that everyone's psychic, and it's so ingrained a part of us that we rarely notice it. The talent may be largely preventative, and that keeps it from being noticed, too. Why? I asked. Because it's a negative factor, Fran. Have any of you ever read James D.L. Staunton's 1958 study of train and airplane crashes? It was originally published in a sociology journal, but the tabloid newspapers rake it up every now and again. We all shook our heads. You ought to, he said. James Staunton was what my students of 20 years ago would have called a real good head, a mild-mannered clinical sociologist who studied the occult as a kind of hobby. He wrote any number of articles on the combined subjects before going over to the other side to do some first-hand research. Harold snorted, but Stu and Mark were grinning. I fear I was, too. So tell us about the planes and trains, Perry says. Well, Staunton got the stats on over 50 plane crashes since 1925 and over 200 train crashes since 1900. He fed all the data into a computer. Basically, he was correlating three factors: those present on any such conveyance that met with disaster, those killed, and the capacity of the vehicle. Don't see what he was trying to prove, Stu said. To see that, you have to understand that he fed a second series of figures into the computer, this time an equal number of planes and trains which didn't meet with disaster. Mark nodded. A control group and an experimental group. That seems solid enough. What he found was simple enough, but staggering in its implications. It's a shame one has to stagger through 16 tables to get at the underlying statistical fact. What fact? I asked. Four planes and trains rarely crash, Glenn said. Oh, fucking bullshit, Harold just about screams. Not at all, Glenn says calmly. That was Staunton's theory, and the computer bore him out. In cases where planes or trains crash, the vehicles are running at 61% capacity, as regards passenger loads. In cases where they don't, the vehicles are running at 76% capacity. That's a difference of 15% over a large computer run. And that sort of across-the-board deviation is significant. Staunton points out that, statistically speaking, a 3% deviation would be food for thought, and he's right. It's an anomaly the size of Texas. Staunton's deduction was that people know which planes and trains are going to crash, that they are unconsciously predicting the future. Your Aunt Sally gets a bad stomach ache just before Flight 61 takes off from Chicago bound for San Diego. And when the plane crashes in the Nevada desert, everyone says, "Oh, Aunt Sally, that bellyache was really the grace of God." But until James Staunton came along, no one had realized that there were really 30 people with bellyaches, or headaches, or just that funny feeling you get in your legs when your body is trying to tell your head that something is getting ready to go way off course. "I just can't believe that," Harold says, shaking his head rather woefully. "Well, you know," Glenn said, "about a week after I finished the Staunton article for the first time, a Majestic Airlines jet crashed at Logan Airport. It killed everyone on board. Well, I called the Majestic office at Logan after things had settled down a bit. I told them I was a reporter from the Manchester Union Leader, a small lie and a good cause. I said we were getting a sidebar on airline crashes together and asked if they could tell me how many no-shows there were on that flight. The man sounded kind of surprised, because he said the airline personnel had been talking about that. The number was 16. 16 no-shows. I asked him what the average was on 747 flights from Denver to Boston, and he said it was 3. 3, Parian says in a marveling kind of way. "Right, but the guy went further. He said they'd also had 15 cancellations, and the average number is 8. So although the headlines after the fact screamed Logan air crash kills 94, it could just as well have read 31 avoid death in Logan airport disaster." Well, there was a lot more talk about psychic stuff, but it wandered pretty far afield from the subject of our dreams and whether or not they had come from the big righteous in the sky. One thing that did come up, this was after Harold had wandered away in utter disgust, was Stu asking Glenn, "If we're all so psychic, then how come we don't know when a loved one has just died or that our house just blew away in a tornado or something?" "There are cases of exactly that sort of thing," Glenn said. "But I will admit they are nowhere near as common, or as easy to prove with the aid of a computer. It's an interesting point. I have a theory—" "Doesn't he always, Diary?" "That has to do with evolution. You know, once men, or their progenitors, had tails and hair all over their bodies, and much sharper senses than they do now. Why don't we have them any more? Quick, Stu, this is your chance to go to the head of the class, mortarboard and all." "Why, for the same reason people don't wear goggles and dusters when they drive anymore, I guess. Sometimes you outgrow a thing. It gets to a point where you don't need it anymore." "Exactly. And what is the point of having a psychic sense that's useless in any practical way? What earthly good would it do you to be working in your office and suddenly know that your wife had been killed in a car smash coming back from the market? Someone is going to call you on the telephone and tell you, right? That sense may have atrophied long ago, if we ever had it. It may have gone the way of our tails and our pelts. What interests me about these dreams," he went on, "is that they seem to presage some future struggle. We seem to be getting cloudy pictures of a protagonist and an antagonist, an adversary, if you like. If that's so, it may be like looking at a plane on which we're scheduled to fly and getting a bellyache. We're being given the means to help shape our own futures, perhaps. A kind of fourth-dimensional free will. The chance to choose in advance of events." "But we don't know what the dreams mean," I said. "No, we don't, but we may. I don't know if a little tickle of psychic ability means we are divine. There are plenty of people who can accept the miracle of eyesight without believing that eyesight proves the existence of God, and I am one of them. But I do believe these dreams are a constructive force in spite of their ability to frighten us. I'm having second thoughts about the Veranol as a result. Taking it is very much like swallowing some Pepto-Bismol to quiet the bellyache, and then getting on the plane anyway. Things to remember. Recessions, shortages, the prototype Ford Growler that could go 60 miles of highway on a single gallon of gas. Quite the wonder car. That's all. I quit. If I don't shorten my entries, this diary will be as long as Gone with the Wind, even before the Lone Ranger arrives. Although please not on a white horse named Silver. Oh yes, one other thing to remember. Edgar Casey. Can't forget him. He supposedly saw the future in his dreams. July 16, 1990. Only two notes, both of them relating to the dreams. See entry 2 days ago. First, Glenn Bateman has been very pale and silent these last 2 days, and tonight I saw him take an extra-large dose of Veranol. My suspicion is that he skipped his last 2 doses, and the result was some very bad dreams. That worries me. I wish I knew a way to approach him about it, but can think of nothing. Second, my own dreams. Nothing night before last, the night after our discussion. Slept like a baby and can't remember a thing. Last night I dreamed of the old woman for the first time. Have nothing to add beyond what has already been said except to say she seems to exude an aura of niceness, of kindness. I think I can understand why Stu was so set on going to Nebraska, even in the face of Harold's sarcasm. I woke up this morning completely refreshed, thinking that if we could just get to that old woman, Mother Abigail, everything would be A-okay. I hope she's really there. By the way, I'm quite sure that the name of the town is Hemingford Home. Things to remember. Mother Abigail. Chapter 47. When it happened fast. It was around 9:45 on July 30th, and they had been on the road only an hour. Going was slow because there had been heavy showers the night before, and the road was still slippery. There had been little talk among the four of them since yesterday morning, when Stu had awakened first Franny, then Harold and Glenn, to tell them about Parian's suicide. He was blaming himself, Fran thought miserably, blaming himself for something that was no more his fault than a thunderstorm would have been. She would have liked to have told him so, partly because he needed to be scolded for his self-indulgence, and partly because she loved him. This latter was a fact she could no longer conceal from herself. She thought she could convince him that Perry's death wasn't his fault, but the convincing would entail showing him what her own true feelings were. She thought she would have to pin her heart to her sleeve, where he could see it. Unfortunately, Harold would be able to see it too, so that was out. But only for the time being. She thought she would have to do it soon, Harold or no Harold. She could only protect him so long. Then he would have to know, and either accept or not accept. She was afraid Harold might opt for the second choice. A decision like that could lead to something horrible. They were, after all, carrying a lot of shooting irons. She was mulling these thoughts over when they swept around a curve and saw a large house trailer overturned in the middle of the road, blocking it from one end to the other. Its pink corrugated side still glistened with last night's rain. This was surprising enough, but there was more. 3 cars, all station wagons, and a big auto wrecker were parked along the sides of the road. There were people standing around too, at least a dozen of them. Fran was so surprised, she braked too suddenly. The Honda she was riding skidded on the wet road and almost dumped her before she was able to get it under control. Then all 4 of them had stopped, more or less in a line which crossed the road, blinking and more than a little stunned at the sight of so many people who were still alive. "Okay, dismount," one of the men said. He was tall, sandy-bearded, and wearing dark glasses. Fran time-traveled for a moment inside her head, back to the main turnpike and being hauled down by a state trooper for speeding. "Next he'll ask to see our driver's licenses," Fran thought. But this was no lone state trooper, bagging speeders and writing tickets. There were 4 men here, 3 of them standing behind the sandy-bearded man in a short skirmish line. The rest were all women, at least 8 of them. They looked pale and scared, clustered around the parked station wagons in little groups. The sandy-bearded man was carrying a pistol. The men behind him all had rifles. Two of them were wearing bits and pieces of army kit.
"Dismount, goddamn you," the bearded man said, and one of the men behind him levered around into the breech of his rifle.
It was a loud, bitterly imperative sound in the misty morning air. Glenn and Harold looked puzzled and apprehensive. That and no more.
"They're sitting ducks," Franny thought with rising panic. She did not fully understand the situation herself yet, but she knew the equation here was all wrong.
4 men, 8 women, her brain said, and then repeated it louder in tones of alarm. 4 men, 8 women.
"Harold," Stu said in a quiet voice. Something had come up in his eyes, some realization.
"Harold, don't—" And then everything happened.
Stu's rifle was slung over his back. He dropped one shoulder so that the strap slid down his arm, and then the rifle was in his hands.
"Don't do it!" the bearded man shouted furiously. "Garvey, Verge, Ronnie, get them! Save the women!"
Harold began to grab for his pistols, at first forgetting they were still strapped into their holsters. Glenn Bateman still sat behind Harold in stunned surprise.
"Harold!" Stu yelled again.
Franny began to unsling her own rifle. She felt as if the air around her had suddenly been packed with invisible molasses, treacly stuff she would never be able to struggle through in time. She realized they were probably going to die here. One of the girls screamed, "Now!" Franny's gaze switched to this girl even as she continued to struggle with her rifle. Not really a girl. She was at least 25. Her hair, ash blonde, lay against her head in a ragged helmet as if she had recently lopped it off with a pair of hedge clippers. Not all of the women moved. Some of them appeared to be nearly catatonic with fright, but the blonde girl and 3 of the others did. All of this happened in the space of 7 seconds. The bearded man had been pointing his pistol at Stu. When the young blonde woman screamed, "Now!" the barrel jerked slightly toward her, like a divining rod sensing water. It went off, making a loud noise like a piece of steel being punched through cardboard. Stu fell off his bike, and Franny screamed his name. Then Stu was up on both elbows, both were scraped from hitting the road, and the Honda was lying on one of his legs, firing. The bearded man seemed to dance backward like a vaudeville hoofer leaving the stage after his encore. The faded plaid shirt he was wearing puffed and billowed. His pistol, an automatic, jerked up toward the sky, and that steel punching through cardboard sound happened 4 more times. He fell over on his back. 2 of the 3 men behind him had jerked around at the blonde woman's cry. One pulled both triggers of the weapon he was holding, an old-fashioned Remington 12-gauge. The stock of the gun was not resting against anything, he was holding it outside his right hip, and when it went off with a sound like a thunderclap in a small room, it flew backward out of his hands, ripping skin from his fingers as it went. It clattered on the road. The face of one of the women who had not reacted to the blonde woman's shout dissolved in an unbelievable fury of blood, and for a moment Franny could actually hear blood raining down on the pavement, as if there had been a sudden shower. One eye peered unharmed through the mask of blood this woman now wore. It was dazed and unknowing. Then the woman fell forward onto the road. The country squire station wagon behind her was peppered with buckshot. One of the windows was a cataract of milky cracks. The blonde girl grappled with the second man who had turned toward her. The rifle the man held went off between their bodies. One of the girls scrambled for the lost shotgun. The third man, who had not turned toward the women, began to fire at Fran. Franny sat astride her bike, her rifle in her hands, blinking stupidly at him. He was an olive-skinned man who looked Italian. She felt a bullet drone by her left temple. Harold had finally gotten one of his pistols free. He raised it and fired at the olive-skinned man. The distance was about 15 paces. He missed. A bullet hole appeared in the skin of the pink house trailer just to the left of the olive-skinned man's head. The olive-skinned man looked at Harold and said, "Now I'm gonna kill you, you son of a bitch!"
"Don't do that!" Harold screamed.
He dropped his pistols and held out his open hands. The olive-skinned man fired 3 times at Harold. All 3 shots missed.
The third round came the closest to doing damage. It screamed off the exhaust pipe of Harold's Yamaha. It fell over, spilling Harold and Glenn off. Now 20 seconds had passed. Harold and Stu lay flat. Glenn sat cross-legged on the road, still looking as if he didn't know exactly where he was or what was going on. Franny was trying desperately to shoot the olive-skinned man before he could shoot Harold or Stu, but her gun wouldn't fire. The trigger wouldn't even pull, because she had forgotten to thumb the safety catch to its off position. The blonde woman continued to struggle with the second man, and the woman who had gone after the dropped shotgun was now fighting with the second woman for possession of it. Cursing in a language which was undoubtedly Italian, the olive-skinned man aimed at Harold again, and then Stu fired, and the olive-skinned man's forehead caved in and he went down like a sack of potatoes. Another woman had now joined the fray over the shotgun. The man who had lost it tried to throw her aside. She reached between his legs, grabbed the crotch of his jeans, and squeezed. Fran saw her hamstrings pop out all the way up her forearm to the elbow. The man screamed. The man lost interest in the shotgun. The man grabbed his privates and stumbled away, bent over. Harold crawled to where his dropped pistol lay on the road and pounced on it. He raised it and fired at the man holding his privates. He fired 3 times and missed every time. It's like Bonnie and Clyde, Fran thought. Jesus, there's blood everywhere. The blonde woman with the ragged hair had lost her struggle for possession of the second man's rifle. He jerked it free and kicked her, perhaps aiming for her stomach, catching her in the thigh with one of his heavy boots instead. She went quick-stepping backward, whirling her arms for balance, and landed on her fanny with a wet splat. Now he'll shoot her, Franny thought. But the second man whirled around like a drunken soldier doing an about-face and began to fire rapidly into the group of 3 women still cringing against the side of the country squire.
"Yeah, you bitches!"
this gentleman screamed.
"Yeah, you bitches!"
One of the women fell over and began to flop on the pavement between the station wagon and the overturned trailer like a stabbed fish. The other 2 women ran. Stu fired at the shooter and missed. The second man fired at one of the running women and did not. She threw her hands up to the sky and fell down. The other button-hooked left and ran behind the pink trailer. The third man, the one who had lost and failed to regain the shotgun, was still staggering around and holding his crotch. One of the women pointed the shotgun at him and pulled both triggers, her eyes squeezed shut and her mouth grimacing in anticipation of that thunder. The thunder didn't come. The shotgun was dry. She reversed it, so she was holding it by the barrels and brought the stock down in a hard arc. She missed his head, but got the place where his neck joined his right shoulder. The man was driven to his knees. He began to crawl away. The woman, who was wearing a blue sweatshirt which said Kent State University and tattered blue jeans, walked along after him, bludgeoning him with the shotgun as she went. The man continued to crawl, blood now running off him in rivers, and the woman in the Kent State sweatshirt continued to wail on him.
"Yeah, you bitches!"
the second man screamed, and fired at a dazed and muttering middle-aged woman. The distance between muzzle and woman was at the most 3 feet. She could almost have reached out and plugged the barrel with her pinky finger. He missed. He pulled the trigger again, but this time the rifle only dry-fired. Harold was now holding his pistol in both hands, as he had seen cops do in the movies. He pulled the trigger and his bullet smashed the second man's elbow. The second man dropped his rifle and began to dance up and down, making high jabbering noises. To Franny, he sounded a little like Roger Rabbit saying, "B-b-b-b-b-please!"
"I got him!" Harold cried ecstatically. "Got him, by God, I got him!"
Franny finally remembered the safety catch on her rifle. She thumbed it off just as Stu fired again. The second man fell down, now clutching his stomach instead of his elbow. He went on screaming.
"My God, my God," Glenn said mildly.
He put his face into his hands and began to weep. Harold fired his pistol again. The second man's body jumped. He stopped screaming. The woman in the Kent State University sweatshirt brought the stock of the shotgun down again, and this time she connected solidly with the crawling man's head. It sounded like Jim Rice connecting solidly with a high, hard fastball. The shotgun's walnut stock and the man's head both shattered. For a moment there was silence. A bird called in it, "Whit-whit, whit-whit, whit-whit." Then the girl in the sweatshirt stood astride the third man's body and gave a long, primeval scream of triumph that haunted Fran Goldsmith for the rest of her life. The blonde girl was Dana Jurgens from Xenia, Ohio. The girl in the Kent State sweatshirt was Susan Stern. A third woman, the one who had squeezed Shotgun's crotch, was Patty Kroger. The other two were quite a bit older. The eldest, Dana said, was Shirley Hammett. They didn't know the name of the other woman, who looked to be in her mid-30s. She had been in shock, wandering, when Al, Garvey, Verge, and Ronnie had picked her up in the town of Archbold 2 days before. The nine of them got off the highway and camped in a farmhouse somewhere just west of Columbia, now over the Indiana state line. They were all in shock, and Fran thought in later days that their walk across the field from the overturned pink trailer on the turnpike to the farmhouse would have looked to an observer like a field trip sponsored by the local lunatic asylum. The grass, thigh high and still wet from the previous night's rain, had soon soaked their pants. White butterflies, sluggish in the air because their wings were still heavy with moisture, swooped toward them and then away in drugged circles and figure eights. The sun was struggling to break through, but hadn't made it yet. It was a bright smear feebly illuminating a uniform white cloud cover that stretched from horizon to horizon. But cloud cover or no cloud cover, the day was hot already, ringing with humidity, and the air was filled with whirling flocks of crows and their raucous, ugly cries. "There are more crows than people now," Fran thought dazedly. "If we don't watch out, they'll peck us right off the face of the earth. Revenge of the blackbirds. Were crows meat-eaters?" She very much feared that they were. Below this steady trickle of nonsense, barely visible, like the sun behind the melting cloud cover, but full of power, as the sun was on this awful, humid morning, the 30th of July, 1990, the gun battle played over and over in her mind. The woman's face disintegrating under the shotgun blast. Stu falling over. The instant of stark terror when she had been sure he was dead. One man crying out, "Yeah, you bitches," and then sounding like Roger Rabbit when Harold plugged him. The steel punching through cardboard sound of the bearded man's pistol. Susan Stern's primitive cry of victory as she stood astride the body of her enemy, while his brains, still warm, leaked out of his cloven skull. Glenn walked beside her, his thin, rather sardonic face now distraught, his gray hair flying wispily around his head as if in imitation of the butterflies. He held her hand, and he kept patting it compulsively. "You mustn't let it affect you," he said. "Such horrors, bound to occur. Best protection is in numbers. Society, you know. Society is the keystone of the arch we call civilization, and it is the only real antidote to outlawry. You must take things like this as a matter of course. This was an isolated occurrence. Think of them as trolls. Yes, trolls, or yogs, or afrits. Monsters of a generic sort. I accept that. I hold that truth to be self-evident. A socio-constitutional ethic, one might say. Ha ha." His laugh was half-moan. She punctuated each of his elliptical sentences with, "Yes, Glenn," but he seemed not to hear. Glenn smelled a trifle vomitous. The butterflies banged against them and then banged off again on their butterfly errands. They were almost to the farmhouse. The battle had lasted less than a minute. Less than a minute, but she suspected it was going to be held over by popular demand inside her head. Glenn patted her hand. She wanted to tell him to please stop doing that, but she was afraid that he might cry if she did. She could stand the patting. She wasn't sure she could stand to see Glenn Bateman weeping. Stu was walking with Harold on one side and the blonde girl, Dana Jurgens, on the other. Susan Stern and Patty Kroger flanked the unnamed catatonic woman who had been picked up in Archbold. Shirley Hammett, the woman who had been missed at point-blank range by the man who had imitated Roger Rabbit before he died, walked a little way off to the left, muttering and making the occasional grab at the passing butterflies. The party was walking slowly, but Shirley Hammett was slower. Her gray hair hung untidily about her face,
and her dazed eyes peered out at the world like frightened mice peering out of a temporary bolt hole. Harold looked at Stu uneasily.
"We wiped them out, didn't we, Stu? We blew them up, scragged their asses."
"I guess so, Harold."
"Man, but we had to," Harold said earnestly, as if Stu had suggested things might have been otherwise. "It was them or us."
"They would have blown your heads off," Dana Jurgens said quietly. "I was with two guys when they hit us. They shot Rich and Damon from ambush. After it was over, they put a round in each of their heads just to make sure."
"You had to, all right. By rights, you should be dead now."
"By rights, we should be dead now," Harold exclaimed to Stu.
"It's all right," Stu said. "Take her easy, Harold."
"Sure. Negative perspiration," Harold said heartily.
He fumbled jerkily in his pack, got a chocolate payday, and almost dropped it while stripping off the paper. He cursed it bitterly and then began to gobble it, holding it in both hands like a lollipop. They had reached the farmhouse. Harold had to keep touching himself furtively as he ate his candy bar, had to keep making sure he wasn't hurt. He felt very sick. He was afraid to look down at his crotch. He was pretty sure he had wet himself shortly after the festivities back at the pink trailer got into high gear. Dana and Susan did most of the talking over a distraught brunch, which some picked at but none really ate. Patty Kroger, who was 17 and absolutely beautiful, occasionally added something. The woman with no name scrunched herself into the farthest corner of the dusty farmhouse kitchen. Shirley Hammett sat at a table, ate stale Nabisco honeygrams, and muttered. Dana had left Xenia in the company of Richard Darless and Damon Bracknell. How many others had been alive in Xenia after the flu? Only three that she had seen, a very old man, a woman, and a little girl. Dana and her friends asked the trio to join them, but the old man waved them off, saying something about having business in the desert. By the 8th of July, Dana, Richard, and Damon had begun to suffer bad dreams about a sort of boogeyman, very scary dreams. Rich had actually gotten the idea that the boogeyman was real, Dana said, and living in California. He had an idea that this man, if he really was a man, was the business the other three people they'd met had in the desert. She and Damon had begun to fear for Rich's sanity. He called the dream man the hard case, and said he was getting an army of hard cases together. He said this army would soon sweep out of the West and enslave everyone left alive, first in America, then in the rest of the world. Dana and Damon had begun to privately discuss the possibility of slipping away from Rich some night, and had begun to believe that their own dreams were the result of Rich Darless's powerful delusion. In Williamstown, they had come around a curve in the highway to discover a large dump truck lying on its side in the middle of the road. There was a station wagon and a wrecker parked nearby.
"We assumed it was just another smash-up," Dana said, crumbling a graham cracker nervously between her fingers.
"Which was, of course, exactly what we were supposed to think."
They got off their cycles in order to trundle them around the dump truck, and that was when the four hard cases, to use Rich's word, opened up from the ditch. They had murdered Rich and Damon and had taken Dana prisoner. She was the fourth addition to what they sometimes called the zoo and sometimes the harem. One of the others had been the muttering Shirley Hammett, who at that time had still been almost normal, although she had been repeatedly raped, sodomized, and forced to perform fellatio on all four.
"And once," Dana said, "when she couldn't hold on until it was time for one of them to take her into the bushes, Ronnie wiped her ass with a handful of barbed wire. She bled from her rectum for 3 days."
"Jesus Christ," Stu said. "Which one was he?"
"The man with the shotgun," Susan Stern said. "The one I brained. I wish he was right here lying on the floor so I could do it again."
The man with the sandy beard and sunglasses they had known only as Doc. He and Verge had been part of an army detachment which had been sent to Akron when the flu broke out. Their job had been media relations, which was an army euphemism for media suppression. When that job was pretty well in hand, they had gone on to crowd control, which was an army euphemism for shooting looters who ran and hanging looters who didn't. "By the 27th of June," Doc had told them, "the chain of command had a lot more holes than it did links.
A good many of their own men were too ill to patrol, but by then it didn't matter anyway, as the citizens of Akron were too weak to read or write the news, let alone loot banks and jewelry stores. By June 30th, the unit was gone, its members dead, dying, or scattered. Doc and